Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
In the media, all we see or hear are relatively wealthy people talking amongst ourselves. Billions of global poor are missing. Many of them are women. Our guest Betsy Teutsch has collected earth-friendly ideas and tech to help them. Her new book is 100 Under $100, 100 Ideas for Empowering Global Women. From Philadelphia, Betsy, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much, Alex.
Well, you know, I've traveled in the developed world and briefly underdeveloped world, I guess we could say, and briefly witnessed deep poverty in several countries. Yet I feel isolated from that, and I'm almost unable to find language to describe it. Who are the global poor, and how can we talk about them?
Well, one way of talking about them is to say the bottom of the pyramid or the base of the pyramid, people that live on a couple dollars a day. But that doesn't mean much to people in the affluent world because the dollar goes much further in poor countries. So the way that I like to think about it is that these are people that live in low resource regions. They're poor, but they're also missing a lot of the infrastructure that we take for granted. So not only do they have to live on a really meager income, but they are lacking water provision. They're lacking sanitation, waste management. They're lacking an electrical grid. They're by definition off-grid, not because they're hippies, but because there's no electricity and they have to patch it together with things like single-use batteries, because you can't charge batteries if you don't have electricity. So they live in a life that's full of poverty traps. It's expensive to be poor. They're also missing transportation grid and municipal services. Many of the global poor now live in expanding slums around the world. We call them shanty towns or favelas. They've moved from remote villages to cities, but they're called para-urban slums. They don't have municipal services. That would be even education and police. So people are just left to fend for themselves.
Okay, so in India, the woman often runs the household purse, and in Africa, I've heard that women do most of the work. Is that why you chose to focus on women, per se, or were there other reasons?
The reason I focused on women is that I have really fallen in love with what we call humanitarian technology. There was a great book about 10 years ago called Design for the Other 90%. The way that really cleverly designed, durable, attractive, affordable tools can really make a big difference. One of the things that I have in the book is called Solar Ear, and it's a very inexpensive, very effective hearing aid, and it uses solar charging batteries, because even if you could give a poor person, one of these extremely poor people, a hearing aid, how would they ever be able to afford the batteries? So something like that is so smart, and it just, I love that kind of design. But I noticed when in the various women's empowerment organizations that I've worked with, schools for girls and funding grassroots organizations that are women's empowerment initiatives, they seem very technology shy. And that reflects the gender divide that you see in technology generally. It's sort of a male domain. In a patriarchy, men literally are the technology gatekeepers. So part of the challenge is that you have to get to the women directly so that they can understand how the technology and these better tools will help them improve their lives. They're already working incredibly hard. So the goal is to get them access to tools so that they can help themselves. You can't just give people these tools. People don't want things that you just give them. We have to create demand. So I figured by focusing on women, that would be the way to unleash a lot of interest in this subject. Women are very effective tools for development. We know that. Educating girls is the most impactful thing you can do for an economy.
Right. Well, you know, reading your work, it seems like any one of these 100 ideas could become a movement in itself. I mean, just the type of stoves that you found, and it could go viral. Is that starting to happen, do you think?
Well, I'm not getting any feeling that at the talks in Paris that poverty is on the agenda. Although Bill Gates is talking about getting people out of poverty and keeping our planet habitable. But when we talk about the big fight seems to be over coal, coal-powered plants and that sort of thing, and that kind of energy provision doesn't do anything for the poor because they're never going to have transmission lines. They're never going to be able to get access to that kind of energy. That will benefit businesses. It'll benefit the economy more generally, but it won't get down to the household level. So I really want to focus on how a household in the developing world could improve quality of life and actually lower their carbon footprint. People don't pay too much attention to the globally poor because, relatively speaking, their carbon footprint is tiny relative to, say, my house in Philadelphia where I live. But there are 3 million households where we could have a huge impact by making sure that people can get solar power, for example. But we're not talking about a solar array of 30 panels. We're talking about one or two panels having a huge impact.
Right. It could provide light for people, including girls, to study at night or get some schooling in or get some extra work done. It's hard to think that in some places when it gets dark, well, it's dark.
Yeah, and people are using kerosene lamps. And kerosene is really smoky. It's a fossil fuel. One of the dirty secrets, literally dirty, is that many governments subsidize kerosene. So they make it cheap and affordable. But it's still a really inferior light, and it's very smelly. It has a lot of toxic fumes that are bad for the planet, but they're really bad for the household. They call it indoor air pollution. It causes a lot of respiratory disease and eye problems and fire hazards. So getting rid of kerosene would be a major improvement for everybody and the planet. And the thing is, a solar light that will replace a kerosene lamp, there's even one on the market called the No Kero light, and that stands for no kerosene. They're very inexpensive now because they use LEDs. LEDs need very little power. They're very efficient. They're hyper-efficient, really. So the lamps now only cost about $10 or $15, and people can actually pay for their own solar lamp by no longer having to purchase kerosene, even subsidized kerosene. So many of these upgrades pay for themselves. It's a question of getting systems in place and people informed.
Now, you mentioned Paris. People like Bjorn Lomborg say we shouldn't bother spending money on alternative energy or reducing carbon emissions. He thinks global poverty is more important. Do we have to choose between the two, Betsy?
Well, that's the thing, we don't. We can do it together. And there's sort of a false impression that what we're going to do is expand the kind of infrastructures that we have in the affluent world to the developing world. And that would be incredibly stupid because they're inefficient and poorly designed. It's just that that's what we have and they work for us. But why would we want to replicate them? A great example is our sewage system. We take all this waste, we call it waste, and we treat it and flush it and spend so much energy getting rid of it, and then we discharge it into the water. But there's a whole movement in the developing world and also off-grid called eco-sanitation, and essentially it captures the assets that are in waste. Yes, they call it poop power, whatever, to be, graphic. And it becomes manure, it becomes humanure, some people call it. It becomes fertilizer, it becomes a soil amendment. But you're capturing it. Also, if you use a biodigester, which you can use animal waste, vegetable waste, human waste, you put it all in there, and it's anaerobic, and it basically is sort of it's a composter, except much faster. And it breaks down into biogas, so you can fuel a stove, say, you pipe it right out of the biodigester. It's like a landfill, I guess, same idea. And then you have organic fertilizer. So that's the kind of infrastructure that we should be building in the developing world to provide waste sanitation for people, not flush toilets and sewers. That just, A, it's impossible. If you've ever been in one of those favelas, you see that you can't just go add pipes. There's no space.
Exactly.
And it's prohibitive. So what we have to do, the fact that we're missing infrastructure in all of these para-urban slums is actually a huge opportunity to redo things and to redesign them so that they're much more eco-friendly and much more sustainable.
Okay, Betsy Teutsch, what is your fantasy package of tools we need to improve the lives of poor women and their families?
Well, I do dream of this. If we could get each household a small solar panel, doesn't have to be a big one anymore because they're so much more efficient. A relatively small one can be a starter. Then they can add, they already have cell phones by and large. More people have cell phones than toilets in the world, a surprising statistic to a lot of people. And then they can get lights and they can charge their cell phone and their lights from the solar panel. And eventually a lot of people are going to have computers and tablets. They're going to just leapfrog right over having televisions because they can go straight to having a screen that is connected through some sort of Wi-Fi to programming. They need to have some kind of water purification. There's a wonderful product on the market called the Solvatten. It was designed in Sweden. That's Swedish for sun water. And it's basically a big black suitcase that you fill with water, you open it, and you do solar water purification. It takes only about 2 hours. There's a gauge right on it that tells you when your water is ready. And it's so hot that it can double as a hot water heater. If you plant a few trees around people's homes, then you have all kinds of eco-benefits, and they could be fruit trees. The moringa tree is incredibly quick-growing, and it has all kinds of health benefits. You can eat the leaves. Everybody calls it kind of the magic tree. So if you just did a couple of those things, you had a biodigester. They have a balloon style that's much smaller for a household, or a composting toilet so that they could safely have the benefits of separating their waste stream from their water stream. That would be huge. And then you get them an improved cook stove or a combination of cooking techniques so that they're not having to go out and girls collecting wood, which they spend hours a day doing that, and it is deforesting. So you can then let their forests regenerate. So a simple package like that, which is probably just a few $100s, and the family itself can pay for it in savings and improved productivity, would do an immense amount towards shrinking carbon footprints and increasing carbon sequestration. It's amazing how much, there's something called black carbon, which is what is produced when people cook over open fires. They're incredibly inefficient, and from what I have read, black carbon is just a technical name for soot and particulates, and it creates kind of a blanket. It's not technically a fossil fuel, but it does stay around, and it's very damaging to the environment. So get rid of all those carbon soot providers, and we'd have a much healthier air quality.
Yeah, it kills millions of people just from cooking inside with open fires, as you describe. And that soot is traveling up to glaciers in the Himalayas and darkening them, causing them to melt faster, and even makes it all the way up to the Arctic, where I've seen pictures of Greenland that's it's now gray land because of the soot that has arrived there from around the world. And then you have this great big cloud forms over India for part of the year and over China that takes away up to 10% of the sun's power. So stoves, incredibly important, and new ways to do that.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Betsy Teutsch. We're talking about her collection of 100 ideas under $100 to empower global women. Betsy, what about population concerns? Are we really post-peak child? That's a new idea for me. What does that mean?
Well, Hans Rosling, who has this wonderful website, Gapminder, is a brilliant Norwegian, and his field, he's an epidemiologist, I believe, his field is visualizing data. And he shows that statistically we're post-peak child. We peaked at the number of babies born a couple of years ago, and nobody knows this, it seems. The number of births per mother has just plummeted over one generation. In Mexico, I think it's dropped from 5 to 2 per mother, just as an example. And that's as a combination of better family planning, but it's also educating girls. When you can keep girls in school and then they can go on to secondary school, high school, they postpone the age of marriage. They're more employable. And then they can get jobs. They contribute to the economy. That's the whole Pacific Rim miracle. And they delay fertility. And then when they educated women have many fewer children. That's a fact that we know around the world. So there's about a 200 million women gap in family planning. So if we met that gap, we could get there even faster. But the increase, we're still going to be experiencing a huge population increase. But it's not because more kids are being born. It's because the kids that were born ahead of them are aging, and life expectancy is increasing. So it's all those extra people that were born in the 70s, 80s, 90s, zeros, all those people aging. But eventually, the predictions are that we will max out at, I think, around 11 billion is the prediction, and then we'll start to gradually taper off. So, of course, a baby born in an affluent part of the world consumes much more than a baby born in the low-income parts of the world because there's only so much people can consume. But it's good news. It, obviously, if there are fewer people than we thought there might be, the predictions when I was, I'm in my 60s, the predictions when I was in high school when Paul Ehrlich was talking about the population bomb, that did not come to be. It's actually much better news than anybody expected. And it's all about educating women.
Well, yes and no. I mean, 11 billion people on this planet to me is a catastrophe. We've got 7 billion now, and we're using up much more than the planet can give. So we're going to have to use a lot of the tools in your book to bring it down to where we can have that many people on the earth. So let's say I agree, and I do agree, that you've got a great collection of tools in this book. The challenge always is, how can we communicate with the billions of people who need it? They're not on the internet. They probably can't read, almost definitely can't afford to buy a book. What are your ideas to propagate what you've found?
That's a great question, because you don't want to just preach to the NGOs. You want to reach the people that need these things. There are a number of outlets. Schools are, of course, our biggest hope. And the advances in education, even though the children don't have computers maybe at home, more and more schools are going to be having them. So, and radio is one of the most effective ways. Since we're on the radio, let's give a shout-out to radio. In places that are still very low-tech, radio is often accessible. People have, communities have radios, and they have radio broadcasting, which is hyper-local. So they can run educational edutainment to explain concepts to people that they might not have otherwise had access to. A really effective way of reaching women is through women's self-help groups and women's cooperatives. They generally are a band of women that are working together. Usually they're farmers or women that have gotten microloans from a microfinance institution. And there's an educational and leadership component to those. So women are exposed to new ideas. They get a chance to develop more self-confidence and become leaders. And together, women, individually, women are very disempowered. But as a group, there's more chance of their being able to really speak up and speak out. One thing that's great about the internet for those that have access is that it's two-way. So it isn't just us telling people what they should do. It's women can be speaking to one another about what they want and what they need. And we can be a little bit more attentive. We have access now to data that no one would have ever had before because of cell phones. So I would expect that the internet in the end is probably going to be the way that people, the demand for it is huge, and a lot of these ideas will come along with it.
So you cover some other topics in the book, such as finance and also some legal things. Just tell us about a couple of the ideas from that section of your book.
I'd love to. I am very much, as I said, in love with the technical, the handheld tools. They're so clever. But I realize that what hampers women is not just the absence of tools. It's patriarchy and legal systems that actively discriminate against women. So I do have a section of human rights. Human rights are women's rights and human rights are the same. So registering the birth of children is very important. Working against violence against women is very important. One of my favorite mashups is a number of women in Egypt started an app called Harass Map, and they use basic mapping skills that you can use, global positioning, that sort of thing. And they designed a map where women can add information where they were harassed in the neighborhood. Often it's when they go to the public latrine, for example. So once women have access to this kind of technology, then they can use it in ways that are useful to them. And they can share with local police, this is a hot spot, this is where a lot of women are getting harassed. And actually they can do something about it. So it's very important that we focus on ways in which women are more legally empowered. And I included a lot of financial tools because I mentioned before that many of these tools pay for themselves because they save money, especially if they're solar. You no longer need to be paying for fuel if you have a solar panel that's charging from the sun. But people need the entry-level buy-in. They don't have enough money to buy a solar panel, but they can buy it on the installment plan. So you need a financial tool to get people over the hurdle so that they can obtain these beneficial tools. So microfinance and insurance, mobile money is huge. In Kenya, for example, most everybody now sends their money electronically. And that's great for poor people because they never had bank accounts. They didn't have access to checking. If they had a cash economy, and cash, women carrying cash is a bad combination. They're extremely vulnerable. This way, they're much more secure, and they don't have to travel places, which is also great from the standpoint of transportation. The fewer people that have to move around, the less gasoline you're going to be using.
Wow, this is like a travel tour. You're telling me things that I have just entirely missed. Is there anything else that you would like to tell our listeners as we wrap up here, Betsy?
Well, I would just like to tell them that in my book, I knew that people would want to be engaged, not just giving money, but in other helpful ways. So for each entry, I included an item that the reader might want to further involve themselves in. So I tried to make it as easy as possible for people to become activists on their own or supporters of causes. It's important. Being an advocate is extremely important. And with the simple tools of the internet, you can really help get messages out about what's important.
Is there a website, a Facebook page, or Twitter tag where people can follow you and this book?
I am at 100under100.org, and I have a ton of resources on my website. So any kid that needs to write a paper, it's all there for you. My Twitter is at Betsy Troitsch. That's my name. And the Facebook page is facebook.com/100under100. So if you like my Facebook page, I keep updating every time I learn something new about one of the tools in the book. They just won an award or they have a new version out. I post that so you can learn more about what's happening in real time with these tools. I keep updating.
Our guest, Betsy Troitsch, has lots of ideas and affordable strategies to start making the lives of global women better. The book is $100 under $100, 100 Ideas for Empowering Global Women. You can find links to Betsy on her Facebook page and following her on Twitter, and I'll put links to all that in my weekly show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Betsy, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
It's been a pleasure, and I think people really need to know that we can get people out of poverty and shrink carbon.
Good news. I'm Alex Smith, reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.